this was an ocean of tall rustling prairie grass, shining and rippling.
Ah, that song's going to be running through my head the rest of the afternoon. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. The young woman singing that is sitting across from me here for another edition of Garden Talk, Lisa Johnson. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there. Thanks for calling me a young woman, too.
Well, you are. And that CD, I love the CD. It's called
Thank
The
you.
Season. People can get it from you. They can go to CD Baby. They can go to Amazon.
Spotify.
Yeah,
there's a lot of places that you can get that, or songs from it.
Yeah, or songs from it. Lots of good songs. And you dedicated that one to the...
The season, the title track, is dedicated to all the awesome master gardeners I've had the pleasure of working with over all these years.
Yeah, that's just wonderful. Have you ever had to sing or sung at a hort event? Or
yeah, actually, there was a conference that I did the other year, and they asked me to do some singing during the break, which was that was a trip. That was fun. And one of the other speakers is somebody I happen to know through folk music, so we did duets. It was a hoot.
Well, I tell you what, it's great to have you back. It's always fun.
Thanks, Larry.
To have you here. And I wanted to start at least today by talking about starting
yeah.
seeds indoors, and get your advice on, you know, maybe the basics first. What advice do you have when it comes to selecting seeds to start indoors?
Sure. The ones that you want to start indoors are those that have a long growing season, that it's we wouldn't have enough time to start them and get a proper harvest if we started them outside. So mostly things like peppers and tomatoes. If you wanted to start some of your cold crops inside, you have broccoli, cauliflower, that's fine as well.
But you're not going to be starting your radishes.
No. Anything that's a root crop does not transplant terribly well. So those would be things you would direct seed outside. And some of the short season crops, too, like lettuce and spinach and so on.
Yeah, for sure. I don't think I gave the number, so let me give that right now. If you have a question or comment or maybe an experience to share, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. And maybe you've got a photo. Maybe there's something you want to brag about with your garden, or maybe there's a plant that's you don't know what it is, or maybe it's was sick this last year. You took some photos of it. Maybe we can, or some insects that have been bothering. Send out those photos to ideas@WPR.org, and we'll take a look at them and see what Lisa's got to say about them. So, soaking seeds. Do you soak the seeds beforehand?
You know, it doesn't hurt, but there are some that really should be soaked before planting, or that it's really beneficial to do that. Peas, for example, benefit from that. Beans benefit from that. A lot of the flower seeds really are best if you soak them. Some lupins and nasturtium and some of the other ones would be good for that.
And too, if you've got some seeds left over from last year, probably a good idea to soak them.
Yeah, it wouldn't hurt. Some of the seeds easily last for 5 years. Others, like lettuce seed, tend to lose their viability pretty quickly. If you have a bunch of seeds that have been sitting around for a while and you're not sure about their viability, you might want to do what's called a seed roll test. It's a germination test. And you take 10 seeds and you put them in a rolled up paper towel that is damp, moist. You don't want it soaking wet, but you want it damp, and you can put it in a Ziploc bag, not sealed, but just to, you know, help keep it damp, and keep the seeds in there in a warm place for as long as it says on the seed package that they're supposed to take to germinate. So if it says they should germinate within 7 to 10 days, leave them there for 7 to 10 days. And then after that, check them and see how many of them have germinated. And because you have 10, you can easily extrapolate that into a percentage. So if six of them germinate, you have about a 60% germination rate. So you may want to seed a little bit thicker.
Makes a lot of sense to me. You know, we talked about starting seeds on, it came up on our Wednesday show this past week with an author. And she talked about using containers that you can plant directly into the ground.
Sure, like peat containers or newspaper or old toilet paper rolls. Or
old egg carton.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's, and do you recommend that as well?
It depends on the material.
Right.
Sometimes things don't decay as quickly as you might hope. Like some of the things that you actually buy in the nursery, there's a product called Coir. It's C-O-I-R, and it's a very fibrous material, and things do root into it nicely, but it does not decay very well. And even some of the peat pots that you buy are a little thick, and sometimes, you know, if they don't decay well, then it can really affect your root structure, and you end up with a cramped root system. So I'm always a little circumspect about that. Make sure that you at least score the material, hopefully cut out the bottom of a pot like that. If it's core, I would simply try and remove it as best as possible. But the peat pots, it's a little iffy.
Yeah,
newspaper,
iffy.
On the other hand, that's going to decay unless it's that nasty, smooth, colored, glossy stuff. That doesn't decay as well. But regular newsprint should decay
pretty well.
Yeah.
I always take everything out.
Yeah, I think it's not a bad idea.
Lisa Johnson, our guest today. Give a call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Melvin from Madison called, couldn't hang on, but wanted to know if you had recommendations on books that feature, you know, what we're talking about on the show today.
I mean, like seeds.
Starting seeds indoors.
Yeah,
just
there's
so sort of basic getting going. In
right.
This,
yeah, there's one, I believe it's called The Seed Starting Manual. It's by an author named Nancy, and her last name is B-U-B-E-L. And I'm not sure how to pronounce that.
Bubel.
Yeah, one of those. But yeah, that's one that I usually recommend. It's kind of the seed starter's Bible is what it's referred to in popular
yeah, circles. And also for Melvin, I think, you know, you look at the extension publications that are available, like,
sure,
through the Learning Store and so forth.
Yeah, we have, there's one called The Vegetable Garden, which has pretty much everything A to Z that you need to know about starting a vegetable garden. And there is some information in there about starting seeds.
I like that one. And it's...
It's also got a great temperature guide.
Yeah,
I think that's,
I was trying to think of that.
Yeah, there's that's one of the things I think sometimes people push it a bit when they're direct seeding outside. And I have in my office a handout that has minimum, optimal, and high end germination temperatures for different kinds of seeds. Usually we don't have to worry about the maximum temperature, but minimum is important because if you put a lot of these seeds out when the soil is only 40 degrees, a lot of them will just sit there. They're not going to germinate. They will rot instead. So you do need to know how warm the temperature of your soil is outside. And getting a soil thermometer, it can be a really good thing to do. And they're not too expensive, you know, $10-$12 or so.
Worth having around. And on the low end, on that cold end, what do you consider a... Where's that range?
You know, it does range. Not off the top of my head. I think 50 is probably one of the, you know, minimums, a common minimum for a lot of those seeds, though. And, you know, the colder it is, the longer it's going to take for that process. So, you know, sometimes starting things too early doesn't get you any farther ahead. It's kind of the rabbit and the turtle, or the tortoise in the hare sort of thing.
And for start, there's always this timing thing too. Okay,
yeah.
If I want tomato plants,
right?
I'm always in a big hurry to get going, and I've failed.
Just start them a little too early.
I've started too early,
yeah.
And then I
didn't. You get these long, huge,
leggy
stretchy
things that are white almost because they didn't get enough sun. So the point is you need to, figure out when. I like to put my tomato – I don't put my tomato plants in until June 1st, or around June 1st. Other people start way a lot earlier than that.
Yeah, and sometimes that works out, but many times it doesn't, particularly here in the lower part of Wisconsin. We've had a lot of really cold, wet springs.
Yep.
And that is not good tomato or pepper growing weather, anything that likes a lot of heat. And you can actually stunt your plants by putting them out too early when the temperature, when the air temperature is below 55, and goodness knows if the air temperature is that cold, then I know that seems warm to us right now, but as far as a tomato plant is concerned, it's still pretty cold. But the soil temperature is likely to be even colder. So between those two things, that can really stunt the growth of your plant. So it's not a bad idea, like you're saying, to wait even past the so-called last frost date. I just wrote a newspaper article about the last frost date, and I'm doing air quotes here. Of course, you can't see me out there in radio land, but that's what I'm doing. Because the last frost date it's actually a median date, so there's actually a 50% chance after that date and before that date of frost. NOAA does have some really cool climate maps that can predict up to 90% probability of different ranges of temperatures. So that's not a bad thing to check out.
And I think it's actually more, at least as important for pepper plants.
Oh, yeah. Peppers, I think, are
very sensitive.
Yeah. And I have had not much luck the past couple of years. And I've been hearing, from some people that have a really warm spot that they, they're still doing well. Mine did not do well at all last year. They just sat there.
Yeah, and my tomatoes didn't even do as well as they normally do. I don't know what it was about the year, but it wasn't the best year of gardening in the Mueller household.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Dave in Waterloo. Speaking of peppers, I think Dave in Waterloo's got a question relating to peppers, maybe. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how you doing? Good show.
Thank you.
Yeah, my question is, I have a ghost pepper plant. Well, it's dead now, but I had it for about 4 years, four seasons, and I didn't know it was indeterminate. But this last fall, I didn't bring it in early enough. I always bring it in the house and let it grow. In the springtime, I cut it way down to the bottom. It got really bushy and produced a lot of peppers, but I failed to bring it in early enough, and it died.
Aww.
But I still have the plant. I still have the plant, and a lot of the peppers are still on it, and it's kind of like it freeze-dried on the plant. But can I use them seeds to replant it, to make more plants?
Well, you could try.
You could try it,
you can always try things. Peppers can be affected by, there's pollination issues. So usually if you have like a sweet pepper and you have hot peppers planted nearby, the gene for hotness, for the capsaicin amount is actually dominant. So you want to protect those sweet peppers, and you don't want to use seeds from those because they're likely to produce hot peppers. With the ghost pepper, since it is already a very, very hot pepper, you're still likely to get hot peppers if you use the seeds, but they might not be exactly what you're expecting because we don't know exactly what kind of pollen, from what kind of pepper the bee, if it was pollinated by an insect, was carrying. So if you had other kinds of peppers around, it might not look the same. Although, that being said, peppers and tomatoes often do a lot of self-pollination, but they are also visited by insects, so you can't be sure of purity unless you have covered those flowers. So all's which to say, maybe.
Yeah. And if you, you know, here they were the kind of freeze dried, as you say.
Yeah, it might be too cold and would they might not live.
Yeah. Would you stick them in some, you know, in a wet condition and try and maybe soak them or something and see if they germinate?
Yeah. It's kind of a guessing game, too, whether they remain dry inside the fruit or whether they have actually rotted by now. So if the fruit wasn't harvested, now if it was harvested and dried, they may be fine. They were probably protected a bit inside the fruit, depending on how cold it got when you brought it in. So I'd say go ahead and give it a whirl, but temper your expectations.
Give it a shot, Dave, and then let us know.
Yeah.
Let us know how that works, okay?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Lisa Johnson, our guest today, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Ditter, our engineer today, Sasha Van Allen, our producer, and you are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Spring in the garden. Well, we're not quite there yet, but we soon will be. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. On this edition of Garden Talk, we started by talking about seeds and getting them, selecting them for the indoors, to start indoors, and visited about that a bit. There are other kinds of things we plan to talk about as well, and we're certainly looking forward to hearing what you've got for questions, so I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Vivian from Green Bay called, couldn't stay online, but wondered about planting avocado pits. Now, I've started them in a, you know, a water glass.
Yeah, that's usually what's recommended, that you kind of suspend them over water with the bottom like quarter actually in the water. And it's usually done by you stick a few toothpicks in it and
right.
Have the toothpicks help suspend the seed above the water glass. You have to make sure that, you know, it doesn't totally have the seed not in water. So you just want about the bottom quarter in water. I have not done much with that myself, so I'm not sure how successful it is, but that's what's usually recommended.
I've had pretty good luck. I had pretty good luck when I did this some years ago, and I just stuck in water. I wondered if a rooting hormone or something would help.
Yeah, that might help. I'm not sure what concentration that you would need. I would imagine too that when you plant it, you do need to be a little bit careful of the roots that have come out, so that you don't, because they're a little bit brittle, break those. But you could try a rooting hormone. It just usually doesn't work real well on seeds, but you know you can
try.
Well,
it's a big
it's a big honking seed.
It's
isn't
a big honking seed.
Yeah.
So maybe it would work for that. I don't know. Well, again, I'll give you the number. We're going to go to 10 here in a minute, but you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Alex from Green Bay was wondering about pros and cons about weed control in the garden, and I'm not sure. There's no con to controlling weeds.
No,
there
is. I'm not sure whether he's meaning by chemical means, for a vegetable garden, I recommend that if at all possible, you don't use chemical controls. But you can certainly use cardboard. You can use straw. There are some organic weed control products that you can try. But the thing about weeds is that they often act as a reservoir for insects like aphids and sometimes diseases. So you definitely do want to control them and not have them competing with your desirable plants.
Well, we've got Ted in Spooner with a question. Let's go there. Ted, hello.
Yeah, hello. I planted my pepper plants. Some of them are coming up, some are not. Did I plant them too soon for Spooner, Wisconsin?
Probably.
Spooner.
Yeah, down here in the Madison area, you usually want to start those things 6 to 8 weeks before your so-called last frost date. And here in the Madison area, that's technically May 15th. So I imagine now you can go online. Actually, if you just Google last frost date, you'll get a map from NOAA that will come up, and then you can click on it and pick your different area. But you're probably zone 3 up there, or so I'm imagining. So probably you might not even be starting yours until April, maybe.
Yeah, you've.
I imagine you don't put your stuff out until mid June or later. Up there?
We put them out way before that.
You can put them out earlier than that? Yeah, okay. I'm just not sure up there exactly what your zone is or what your so-called last frost date is. The thing is that you don't want to put them out too soon and have them get stunted because the weather is too cold. Do you have any idea when your last frost date is?
No, I didn't track them.
Okay, yeah.
I'm down in a low area. We have frost. A lot of times when we're going to have frost, I put the sprinklers on just to keep it from freezing, but it gets pretty cold. So
yeah.
I suppose that don't help the plants either.
Yeah, peppers and tomatoes are pretty cold sensitive, so usually you don't want to put them out before the nights are going to be 55 or over. Actually, when they get to the point where they're producing flowers, if you get a lot of nights where it's lower than 50 degrees, they can actually abort those blossoms and the fruit fails to develop. So it's really important with those.
Yeah, and you're right on the edge. I took a quick look. You're right on the edge here of May, around the end of May, May 30th.
Yeah, okay.
To June 6th.
Yeah, so you would want to start your pepper seeds then 6 to 8 weeks before that.
So now what can Ted do with these pepper plants that he's got going? I mean,
you can continue to grow them, and you know, you can still put them out. They just might end up being a little bit large and leggy. You might have to stake them.
Yeah, and you'd probably want to toughen them up a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. I recommend hardening off anything that you've started inside before you put it outside. And hardening off means that you're preparing the seedling to be able to tolerate the different temperature, light, and wind conditions that are happening outside. So usually you want to spend a week or so doing that. I suppose it's kind of like preparing your youngster to go to kindergarten or something.
Yeah,
you know, it's a different environment. And with plants, you want them to start producing a thicker cuticle. That's the outer layer that's over the leaves and stems. It's kind of a waxy layer, and it helps protect them from drying out. So if you start to expose them to the sun and the wind and so on slowly over a week or even a week and a half or so, what people will often do is they'll put their plants out in partial shade so that they're not getting direct sun, because you don't want to burn the foliage. But usually if they've been kind of hardened off over a week and a half or so, you can plant them out without worrying that they're going to get too damaged. And it's not a bad idea to actually plant them out towards the end of the day so that they don't experience being transplanted and having a full day of sun at the same time.
Yeah. And when you walk by those plants, just run your hand over them a little bit.
Yeah, that helps to build the cuticle, actually. Yep,
it does.
That's a good piece of advice.
Just rub your hand over them, brush them a little bit, and that helps toughen them up. Tim in Mauston, it's your turn. Hi, Tim.
Good morning.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Well, I'm calling to get some advice on how to handle these nasty Japanese beetles that seem to love our grape plants, our leaves.
Well, that's one of their favorites.
Yes, yes, it is.
Grapes, and, roses.
Yeah, beans, lindens. Yeah, they like a lot of different things, unfortunately. It's really hard to grow something, you know, not have something on your property that they like. And I really wish I had a silver bullet to recommend to you. If you're, are you by any chance near a golf course?
Well, there's one close enough.
Like within a mile or so?
No.
Okay, good. Well, that's,
yeah, that helps.
That's helpful.
That helps.
The beetles really like to lay their eggs in well-cared-for turf. So lawn grasses, or in this case, golf course grasses that are well-watered and well-fertilized, that have really nice, tender root systems, that's where they really like to lay their eggs. So if you have one of those lawns that is really beautifully taken care of, that's kind of a mecca there for Japanese beetles to come to and lay their eggs. Or if your neighbors do. Unfortunately, the adults are pretty darn good flyers, so even if you control the grubs that hatch from the eggs that are laid in your own yard, if your neighbors don't, then you're still likely to get beetles from there. One thing we don't recommend is using the beetle traps, because research shows that that brings in about four times as many beetles as you would have had if you had not used those. Now, if you're out in the country somewhere and you can put one of those traps 200 to 300 yards away from your crop, that can actually be helpful in drawing them away from your crop. But if you're in a typical suburban setting, that's not recommended at all.
How big is your, how many plants do you have? Is this an acre or something, or is it just along a fence?
Small planting. We've got about 24 plants.
Okay.
Because you could cover.
Yeah, I was going to recommend if you had, you know, just a few plants to try and cover those. What some people will do is they'll build kind of a cage-type structure and put screen over it, like to protect raspberries and so on. The thing is, though, that if you have a crop like raspberries or grapes where you need things to be pollinated, you're keeping out the pollinators as well as the Japanese beetles. It is really tough. I know that at the West Madison Research Station, they have used, because they're only using organic products, they have used 70% neem oil, but you have to, you know, apply that about every 5 days or so. And especially if it rains, it doesn't maintain its efficacy for that long. And it mostly will keep them off the leaves. You're not going to want to be spraying the fruit that's developing. But yeah, I wish I had a better advice for you. We do have a fact sheet that you can find at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic site. So if you just Google PDDC, which stands for Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, and UW, you should be able to come up with that website, and it's under the fact sheets. It has a few recommended procedures, but Japanese beetles, because they're around for so long, are really just very tough to try and control, and especially since you have to try and control the grub stage as well as the adult stage. It's the good thing is, if you've only just recently been infested, with Japanese beetles, typically there'll be like a peak of really high Japanese beetle activity for about 5 years, and then it'll start to level out. But if you're growing a crop that they really like grapes, you probably always will have some issues with them.
And there is another publication you might want to consider, which I really like, Growing Grapes in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's a nice one, too.
It's a UW Extension one. I think you can get that at the Learning Store. I don't know if it's at the PDDC.
No, it's just at the Learning Store. So you would just Google Learning Store UW.
And that is a really nice little publication. It's got some good information in it. Tim, yeah. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jackie and Rudolph, it's your turn. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and thank you for donating your time to WPR to answer questions. But I have a question. When I first started our garden, made it in 05, we didn't have cucumber beetles. And the last 3 years, they're horrible in all my squash, both my zucchinis and my squash plants to get into the blossom. So what do I do?
Yeah, that is definitely a problem. I mean, you can use a floating row cover at some points during the year, but once it comes to the point where you need to pollinate, then of course you have to take those off. So some things that you can do are, you know, in terms of timing, trying to plant things a little bit later. You can also use crop rotation if you have, you know, a big enough space. What you might want to do is actually not grow some of the cucurbits for a year or so and see if that makes any difference. If the beetles don't have their preferred crop to feed on, then they usually end up having to go elsewhere. Also, good garden cleanup, making sure that you get rid of all the old materials where there may be some overwintering going on can be helpful. I just gave a talk this past weekend on vegetable garden insects that was partly put together by our specialist, Russ Groves, who is our vegetable entomologist. And there was within it a chart about cucurbits, which include the melons and the squash and the cucumbers, and which ones are least favored by things like cucumber beetles and squash bugs. And unfortunately, I don't have that with me. But if you want to contact me at the Dane County Extension Office, I'd be happy to provide that for you.
So there you go. And actually, you guys are online. So UW Extension Dane County.
Yep.
Go to that and just click on and you can.
Horticulture, and I'll come up and you can email me.
There you go, Jackie.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Michael often calls from New Zealand, but he's emailed us, I think, right now. They're currently near the end of summer in New Zealand.
Wow.
He had a question about his orchard. They planted a small orchard with a variety of different types of pears, apples, and plums a few years ago. There's not much fruit at this stage as the trees are relatively young. So they've been trying to avoid picking to see if it's ripe and ready to go. Is there another method, or what do you suggest?
Yeah, one thing to, I mean, this won't help you right now, but in the future, if you plant semi-dwarf or dwarf trees, they are more precocious about bearing fruit than standard trees. So standard trees are the full-size trees. Now, they usually are going to take 5 to 7 years to start producing regularly. Unfortunately, there's nothing you can really do to speed that up a whole lot. So, you know, if you're on your third year, you might start getting some regular, you know, fruiting fairly soon. So it doesn't say exactly when you planted. But, you know, once they're 4 or 5 years of age, they should be able to harvest.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
There you go. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it. Tom in Plover, we'll go to you next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question about starting seeds indoors.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I don't have a good south window or any sunlight in the home. So I did try it a couple years ago in my basement with grow lamps, and it didn't turn out very well. I ended up with these pathetic, spindly-looking things.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if there's any good grow lamp or something like that I could use to start that. I do have like little heat coils that I put underneath.
Okay.
Soil warm, and then I also hung like my basement isn't finished, so I just would hang strips of plastic or whatever to kind of create a mini greenhouse effect, but I'm just wondering about the lamps.
Right? How far away were the lamps that you used?
That was what I was going to ask.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I read about that. I they were fluorescent grow lights or whatever they call them for, like, aqua or plants or whatever. But I did lower them down so they're, like, 2 to 3 feet above the plant itself, but it still didn't
too far.
It should be a couple of inches above the top of the plant.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, well, there's mistake number one.
I'm glad, though, that you're using the heat coils. I had tried to germinate seeds in my basement because it was the only place I could shut the door and not have cats interfering with the process. So I had problems because my basement was too cold. The light, you know, the lights that I was using were okay, but the soil temperature was too cold. So I'm glad to hear that you're doing that. But grow lights pretty well duplicate the light wavelengths from the sun. You need both the red wavelengths and the blue wavelengths are the ones that are most heavily involved in photosynthesis. There are some really nice LED lights out there now too, but they tend to be pretty expensive. So
they last a long time.
They last a heck of a long time. You're absolutely right about that. But they, I'm hoping that, you know, as technology advances, that the price will come down on those. But yeah, the fluorescent tubes are fine, but you do need to have them just an inch or inch
couple
and a half
inches.
Above the top of the plant, and they should be on 16 hours a day. You don't want them more than that, but about 16 hours a day is what's recommended.
Yeah, they were
like wattage or for brightness or whatever. I think that I wasn't getting enough brightness.
Well, if you're 2 or 3 feet away, they were spindly for a reason.
Yeah.
They were trying to get up there to the light.
Trying to reach.
Get up there for the light. So, yeah, get it down there close. If you'd had it even 6 inches away, you'd have gotten a lot better result, I think, Tom.
Yeah, and you do, of course, as the seedlings get taller, need to raise the lights up. Or if you have the seedlings on boxes, lower the seedlings. Either way, that'll work.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got a garden photo of some sort you want to send us, that's fine too. Just go to ideas@wpr.org. Our guest today, Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network, taking a look at all kinds of things today on the Ideas Net Garden Talk Show with our guest, Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Question or comment or maybe a gardening experience to share, give a call, 800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. Julie emailed, she said last year she planted 3 small gardens. She didn't get anything out of it other than 1 tomato and some jalapenos. She wants to grow pumpkins, but they never seem to grow as the plant seems to die before any fruit can ever produce. She prefers planting organic, which she gets locally in Cottage Grove. She uses organic soil and just can't figure out why nothing's really growing. She doesn't have weeds she does have weeds that can take over, and she says, please help.
Oh, I'm sorry, Julie. That's sad. Not a lot of clues to help me figure out what's going on here. I mean, your tomato plant should have produced more than 1 tomato. I'm not sure whether you're starting the seed yourself or whether it looks like you may be
I think she's
buying them as transplants.
Yeah, she should be.
Yeah. Because transplants are usually pretty reliable. I'm glad you got some jalapenos at least. Pumpkins, I'm not sure whether you're direct seeding those or whether you're using transplants. If they're dying before they produce any fruit, I guess I would recommend trying to get transplants if you can find them. A lot of places don't produce cucurbits as transplants because they can be a little fussy about their root systems when you actually plant them.
Yeah, they're usually seeds.
But if you wanted to try starting your own inside, you could do that, but I would use like a peat pot or something that you could just plant it as is, but again, score the pot and cut out the bottom. There are a number of diseases that pumpkins can get. I'm wondering if maybe the soil was too wet, if that could have caused the plant to rot, or perhaps it was attacked by squash vine borer.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, or there are some insects like cucumber beetles that can carry bacterial wilt, which also makes the plant wilt up and die. So there are a lot of different things that could have gone wrong there. Sounds like you're in the Madison area. So if you'd like to shoot me an email with a little bit more detail, maybe I can help you do some more detective work with this.
Yeah, it's probably not a bad idea. And the weeding, of course.
Yes,
weeds got
weeding,
away. Got to get the weeds out.
Got to get those weeds out, especially if you have something nasty like perennial weeds like Canada thistle. Those actually do have allelopathic chemical in their root system. So not only do they just compete for space, but they actually kind of suppress the desirable plants. So you can use cardboard to help keep those down. You can use straw or newspaper covered with straw. But yeah, weeds are important to try and control.
Alex from Green Bay emailed back to clarify his question about weed control. He's considering using silage bag pieces like they use on farms for weed control. One side's black, one side's white. Any concerns with too much heat, et cetera, by using this to stop weeds from growing?
No, actually, some of my colleagues have done some research with different types of weed control fabric, which I don't recommend for perennial gardens, but, you know, for a vegetable garden where you're taking them up every year, that's absolutely fine. I would put the black side facing up so that you get the advantage of the heat. I shouldn't be a problem with any of that.
No, I wouldn't think so. Doug emailed about the Japanese beetles. He suggested domestic ducks. He said they help a lot, and they love Japanese beetles.
I know that chickens will eat them too, but unfortunately, the beetles have to be on the ground for the chickens. I'm not sure whether the ducks will be able to reach up there and get them or not. But, yeah, it's good to know.
And then we've got Ed from Whitefish Bay. We're getting lots of emails today. Are broccoli and broccoli rob the same thing? He's planted broccoli rob several times, and it goes to flower almost immediately. Is he doing something wrong? He's had trouble finding broccoli seeds on the broccoli plant at hothouses to put in his garden.
Yeah, regular broccoli and broccoli rob are, I believe they're the same species, but they're a slightly different form. The broccoli rob tends to have you might refer to it as stemmy broccoli.
Yeah.
It has longer stem. It does go to flower fairly quickly, so you do need to harvest it fairly soon.
Tastes just like broccoli.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it kind of depends. I suppose you could plant if you want something early. That broccoli rob would be earlier.
Yeah, it would be. It would be.
Plant a little on the beach.
And, for seeds for broccolini, not sure. whether I've seen that. You know, you might want to try going online. Some of the bigger seed producers like Johnny's Selected Seeds or Burpee or Parks might have those if you're not able to find them locally.
Mary from Port Wayne said, now we're back to cucumber beetles. So we're jumping around a little bit here, but that's all right. That's what we usually do on Garden Talk. She suggested spinosad spray for cucumber beetles. They don't like the taste of it.
Yeah, spinosad is one of the, I think I mentioned there are some organic products out there. That is one of them. Spinosad is one of those that is based on a naturally occurring bacterium. It's actually a fermentation product. There's a really interesting backstory about spinosad, which is that the bacterium that produces the product that is used for that was found by an entomologist on vacation. I think it was in Jamaica or someplace. It was near a rum factory. And he took a soil sample and found that bacterium. And so there are a number of different insects that you can use that for spray. And you know, there are BT can be used for controlling some of those insects as well. You just need to be sure to apply it at the appropriate time. So, you know, with something, a crop like cucumbers or melons or squash, any of those cucurbits, using the floating row cover early, then once they start to flower, taking that off, and then using things like spinosad or some of the other organic products to keep off the beetles can be very successful.
Why not? Liz from Fall River emailed about avocado pits, so we're back to avocados here. She started several avocado trees by putting the seed in a cottage cheese or a sour cream-sized container filled with potting soil.
Okay, so she didn't even do the pre-rooting in water.
No.
Okay.
She now has 8 that are about 4 feet tall.
Wow.
She's transferred them into bigger pots. It takes them outside for the summer.
I wonder if she's gotten any avocados.
Yeah, she keeps them on her sun porch. So she operates with her avocado trees like I operate with Limey.
Limey, yeah.
My lime tree.
How's Limey doing?
Limey has come down with scale.
Oh, that's a bummer.
It is
neem
worst.
Oil is recommended.
It is, and never in all the years that plant never had scale, and suddenly there's scale.
Yeah, it's like spontaneous generation.
Where
did those come from?
Where did that come from? So anyway, I'll give you, I'll keep running updates on Limey. Dennis and Phillips, it's your turn. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I planted rutabaggy, and I haven't planted that in years. And it was the beautiful plants, but the rutabaggies are full of a bug. Or rotten spots in them.
Okay, so like larva?
No, well, at what time when they were mature, I planted them, they were 6 inches around, beautiful, and most of them were hollow and like a mush inside. Uh-oh. And I had an old-timer, I talked to them, and they said they put wood ashes on the ground. I do all organically garden, you know, I don't.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Boy, I am not sure what exactly is going on there, whether, I mean, there are some, especially with root crops, there are some things that if you don't have enough, like calcium in the soil that, you know, can cause that kind of hollow sort of thing. I've got to say that rutabagas are not a crop I have dealt with a whole lot.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think, we don't even have a publication on rutabagas.
Surprisingly enough, no, because they're very popular in north central Wisconsin. I mean, I think was trying to remember who has a rutabaga festival. There's even a rutabaga queen.
Oh, wow.
I think it's either Rice Lake or Cumberland.
Yeah.
One of the two.
You have fairly sandy soil there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he's in the area where
yeah,
it
so
works.
That should, because that was going to be my other speculation, was that maybe it was root rot. If it was in heavier soil, especially with all the rain we got last year, but in a sandy area, that does almost sound like a disease issue. You might want to next year, if you're having problems with it before it totally turns to mush, maybe send a sample into Brian Huddleston.
Who's the extension person in the Phillips area? I'm trying to remember. I can't remember off the top of my head.
I'm not sure either.
Go online and put in Dennis, or maybe we can find it too. UW Extension Phillips.
Yeah, or whatever the name of your county is.
Yeah,
I can't remember which county Phillips is in.
And get the name of the extension agent, because I'm almost sure the extension ag agent or horticulture agent for the area would have had this question before, because that's an area where rutabagas grow pretty well. So.
Now, as far as the wood ash, that's going to raise the pH of your soil. If you've got sandy soil, that's probably not, a problem. Down here in the South, of course, we're always trying to lower the pH of our soil and definitely don't want to add wood ash. But
good luck, Dennis. Thank you so much for calling. And do get a hold of your extension agent in your county. And Sasha just reminded me that the Rutabaga Fest is in Cumberland. So I was close.
You were very close.
Right. Oh, man. Lisa Johnson, our guest today. She's a UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Lisa Johnson's singing there for us, and she's also talking and not singing here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. She's a UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Always great to have her come by. Certainly, if you have a gardening question, maybe there's an issue with some plants, maybe you've got some wondering about different types or varieties that you want to plant this year or try this year, I hope you'll give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And, of course, Phillips is in, we had a question about Phillips, and Phillips is in Price County, which I knew that. I just couldn't pull it out of my head. Art Lirsch is the area extension director in Price County. So for our caller from Phillips, that's the place to go. Yep, Price County. Art Lirsch, he's the person that's going to be able to help you out. And let's turn to another email from Veronica. How do you treat fruit flies on raspberries?
Ah, okay. So you're probably talking about the spotted wing Drosophila, which is a type of fruit fly. Boy, that's another. We're getting all the tough insects today.
For sure.
Well, there isn't a whole lot that you can do once it starts producing raspberries. We do have a fact sheet at the PDDC, the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic site, that tells you how to make a trap, which is mostly for monitoring purposes. But what our fruit specialist has said is that it's probably best, or our fruit entomologist, if you can grow a raspberry that fruits earlier in the year as opposed to later, because what we're finding is that by the time the population of the Drosophila ramps up, it's going to be a worse problem on the later season fruiting raspberries. That one is just really, really causing us fits and is, I suspect, going to very much affect whether we can raise raspberries or not in this state.
Yeah, commercially, it's disaster.
Yeah, right, exactly. You know, if they were big like Japanese beetles, you could, you know, do some fencing or you could screening, I should say, and you could, you know, have high tunnels to produce them in and have the pollinators in there and so on. But they're so darn tiny that they get through anything.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, I don't have a whole lot of solutions for you on that. But you do check out that fact sheet. There may be some of the organic products. And of course, that's another thing is that you don't want to be spraying something that you're going to eat. And of course, the fruit flies aren't there until the actual fruit starts to be produced. What some people are doing is they're harvesting the raspberry just a tad early and freezing it. And if there are any larvae in there, choosing to ignore that. And, you know, once they're frozen, it's an extra little bit of protein that hopefully you won't notice. But yeah, they're such a problem because they go after ripe fruit instead of overripe fruit, like most fruit flies.
We have Mary in Eau Claire up next with a question. Mary, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I planted, you know, I went on the hunt for these pepper seeds and, you know, special pecan pepper, and I had the heating mat and the grow light, and nothing ever came up. I don't know if it was, can you be too damp or?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah. You can. Especially if your little seed packets are. Were you growing in flats or in the little market packs or pots or?
Yeah, the little market things that they're Jiffy pots. They kind of expand when you water them.
Oh, okay. And how often were you watering?
Well, they say that, you know, the instructions had keep the bottom of the pan slightly, you know, with a little bit of water showing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has like a little reservoir sort of, you know, indentation in the grow box thing.
Okay. Huh. Mm. You know,
but
maybe.
Usually, yeah, pep.
Maybe you want to try ahead. Just like Jiffy mix or another seed starting mix and try them in a market pack. It sounds like usually
too wet to me.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Usually when people say pepper seeds aren't germinating, I always wonder if it's warm enough, but you said you've got bottom heat and you said you've got light. So, I mean, and it could be occasionally you'll get a bad, batch of seeds.
Batch.
Or maybe something in the shipping, you know, if they froze during shipping or something could affect that.
Don't give up.
Yeah, I would definitely not give up, okay. But maybe get another packet of seeds and try that.
Yeah.
Right
and
again.
It's too early to start them anyway.
Yeah, for your area, I would wait a few weeks.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. Stephen Thiensville emailed, they have a small fish pond. It's the plastic insert type, and it's this about the size of a kid's wading pool, but it's deeper. It has two levels. The deep is 3 feet. The middle is about a half a foot deep. Sort of a shelf area. Mm-hmm. Is there a water veggie that can be grown on the shelf in a pot, for example? And he says rice.
Well,
I wouldn't try rice.
Yeah, rice you need an awful lot of it to get much of anything, and it's difficult because it needs to be rooted into a substrate. So you'd have to have, you know, dirt on the bottom of your pond, and that's probably not really recommended.
But you can put the pots on the shelf.
Yeah, yeah. We were actually thinking about watercress might be something you might want to try in that.
I like the idea of watercress.
Yeah, that'd be kind of cool.
Your own watercress. And it looks nice. So there you
yeah,
go.
Yeah, it does.
Peggy in Hudson, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
I am a recreational gardener and have raised beds, and I'm dealing with a fair bit of tomato blight. And I rotate my crops every year, and I'm wondering how I can fix that problem and what the remedies are.
Okay, so I need to kind of try and break down what kind of tomato blight you're getting. Is this on the leaves? Is it on the fruit?
Yeah, both. So my plants start out very spindly, and I have a feeling that's a pH issue, which I think is separate from this. And then as the plants are growing, the leaves die off in the bottom. They get the yellow
okay.
and brown spots okay. all over, and then the fruit has a similar appearance as well.
That could be two different things.
Yeah, it could.
Probably is.
So does the fruit get rotten on the bottom?
Sometimes, or? But not all the time. That's not an issue. That's not an issue that I'm really facing.
Okay. And what kind of soil do you have in your raised beds?
Well, my raised beds have been there for about 10 years, and I amend them every year with organic compost. We started out with brown, you know, just dirt that we bought. We mixed it with peat. So it was a very good mixture. The first 2 years of the garden were beautiful,
mm-hmm.
but it's been the last 2 or 3 years, and I don't know if it's a moisture issue because we've had so much rain in Wisconsin. The dirt foundation, in my opinion, was good.
Okay.
And I do amend it with organic compost every year.
Okay. What I would recommend then is usually this disease comes from the soil, which was why I was asking what the source of your soil was. And it does tend to build up over time. So even if you're rotating, if you had other types of crops from Solanaceae family, so if you put peppers in there or eggplants or potatoes, you might still be ending up feeding that those fungi. So what I would do is a couple different things you could try. You could try using a grafted tomato, which is more expensive, but the root system is resistant to Septoria and early blight, which is what I assume we're probably dealing with. You can also use some kind of barrier between the top of the soil and the leaves, because usually the leaves are going to be the main infection point. So doing things like removing the bottom leaves so that if any soil splashes up when you water or it rains, that it doesn't have anything to settle on, using some kind of mulch, so like newspapers with straw over the top so that you have a physical barrier between the plant and the soil, and then also keeping the canopy thinned out as much as possible so that the leaves remain as dry as possible, which is an inhospitable place for fungi to have spores germinate, and also watering from the base. There are some resistant tomato cultivars, so you might also look into that. If you do a little internet research, you can come up with some resistant varieties.
So there you go, Peggy. I hope good luck. It's once you
it's
get
a hard
it,
one. Yeah.
Once you get it, it's miserable.
Yeah,
that's what it is. That's what it is. Miserable. Oh, man. Bob emailed. He has jumping worms. He wanted to try early bird fertilizer this spring to control them, as you have suggested in the past. He was at Garden Expo. The manufacturer has stopped making that fertilizer.
I know. I'm heartbroken.
Yeah. So do you have any other suggestions?
That was my only tool that I could recommend, you know, other than picking out the worms as you find them. I'm actually working with the Arboretum. We're going to hopefully this year start some controlled trials to see if there are other the ingredient in the early bird from the tea seed meal is a plant saponin that is the active ingredient that is affecting the worms. So we're going to try some other types of plant saponins to see if we can come up with another possibility. What I'm hoping is that maybe when tariffs are no longer such a problem, because that's part of the reason that... because the active ingredient, the tea seed meal, comes from China. And, of course, we've got other things in the news that are maybe getting into that. But we're hoping that maybe they will start manufacturing it again. I don't have any idea, though. And as far as I know, nobody else is in the market doing that. If anybody knows if somebody else is producing a tea seed meal fertilizer, I'd be very pleased to know that.
That is really, really too bad. Well, maybe,
yeah, it's
maybe
all
they'll
connected,
pick it up
right?
again. Yeah, it's all connected. So what's coming up on the Master Gardener agenda? We haven't talked about Master Gardener
as much. Oh, yeah. Well, actually, I just started my class for this year on Wednesday. A lot of the counties run theirs in the fall, so they're all on different schedules in different counties. So if you're interested in the program, what you need to do is go to your county extension office website and see when they are offering the training. The Master Gardener Volunteer Program is a really wonderful way to give back to the community and learn about horticulture at the same time. Master gardeners do all kinds of great things for their communities. They volunteer in school gardens. They volunteer in botanical gardens. They help us out at the county offices answering questions just like we're doing today. So it's a wonderful way to learn, and you meet so many people that are like-minded about gardening and passionate about gardening. And I just really feel privileged to have that be part of my job, working
Isn't
with folks
great?
Like that. Yeah.
And explain the process. I mean, and you don't have to be some big plant expert to get started
at all. No, I mean, that's what the training is all about. We train you in the basics of a lot of different areas of horticulture, anything from you learn about insects, you learn about soils, you learn about annuals, you learn about trees and shrubs and fruits and vegetables. And we have... specialists that provide some of that content. A lot of the content comes from our learning store site as well. There are some administrative hoops to jump through. There's a background check and some forms that you need to fill out. But the training is usually a 3-hour lecture, and some counties offer it in the daytime, some offer it in the nighttime. I flip back and forth between years offering it in the daytime and the nighttime.
And how many sessions are there?
Well, most counties offer 12 to 13. Mine is 19 sessions, and we offer it over a 6-month period so that you get to work in our teaching garden and follow that through the year. It also means that you get to see plant development over time.
Yeah,
and
that's great.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate that, and if you're in the Madison area, or even if you're not and you want to come down and take a tour of our teaching garden, I'd be more than happy to set that up. You can find out more about the teaching garden at Dane County Extension website. We have a system where all of the perennials and woody plants have QR code labels on them, so that you can, if you have a smartphone, walk up to the label, point your phone at it, and that will take you directly to our blog site that has all the information you would want to know about that plant: when it blooms, how tall it gets, how wide it spreads, if it has any problems like rabbits liking it, you know, what color the flowers are, if it's a native, if it attracts butterflies, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah.
Lots of great information. That'd be a lot of fun to take your 19 sessions.
Yep.
Yep, it's perfect. Lori in Kenosha has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Yeah, so I've noticed the last couple of years my dark leafy vegetables like my spinach and my collard greens, kale, have been being eaten by, I believe they're moths. They're a light pale yellow color, and they keep laying eggs underneath the bottoms of the leaves.
Sure, that's probably imported cabbage worm. It is actually a butterfly, but they show up pretty early in the season, usually in May, and start checking out your coal crops. The nice thing about having it, if there is an upside to this, your collard greens and your spinach and your kale don't need to be pollinated. So floating row cover is an awesome way to prevent that kind of thing from happening. There are also a couple of other insect pests. There's a cabbage looper that also has a greenish caterpillar, and there's a diamondback tussock moth. I would definitely recommend floating row cover for that. And you can, if you get some higher hoops, you can grow those greens under there all season. You just need to check periodically to make sure that nothing's gotten underneath the floating row cover.
Yeah, there you go, Lori. Thank you so much for calling. Got a great email from Margie in Phillips. She claims that planting tomatoes and peppers in old coolers does the trick for growth in the short growing season in northern Wisconsin. It keeps the soil warm. She says you can put two pepper plants in a 35-quart cooler.
Yeah, I bet you can.
There's usually a drain. You can leave that open, or you can drill a couple of holes in the bottom. And she says it's a way to repurpose what would have gone into the landfill anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And she's used hers for years with good results.
That's nice. Yeah.
I love that idea.
Yeah, that's a very neat idea. I like that.
Especially for northern Wisconsin. She's in the Phillips area.
Yeah,
there.
I mean, it's just another type of raised bed for the most part. You know, functions the same way. So,
someone wondered about the cost of the Master Gardener program. Is there, there is a cost?
Yeah, there is a cost. The manual has a cost, and the background check has a cost. And in Dane County, at least, our association fee is factored into that. Now, we're a little bit more expensive than surrounding counties because we have more classes. But it's $260 in Dane County, and you can break that into two payments. I think other counties may be under $200.
So that's pretty darn good deal.
Yeah.
when you get right down to it, because
and
that's
you get
a lot of
university
education.
Specialists as speakers, and
you speak and others speak from campus and so forth.
Yeah.
Well, Lisa, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I always love the show.
Well, thank you very much. Lisa Johnson, our UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. And I'm sure, I know she'll be back again. Monday, though, we'll have a new series of biographies for kids featuring modern women in the world of work. And then Mike Crane, WPR Director's on to take your questions. And we'll go out listening to Lisa here. Listen to her playing her guitar. Lisa Johnson. Her CD, by the way, is titled The Season. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.